What is... Dax, are you...
Tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker? On all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all. So we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge! Trucks up 3.9%!
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and we're back for part two of our discussion of the defense in that divisional round loss to the Buffalo Bills. Disappointing end to the season, of course. Gabe Ferguson making it a little better by having a down-to-earth discussion about what happened in the game. We talked, I think, primarily in that first episode about who's to blame, because it seems to be the topic all over Twitter and everything, just how you assign blame for this loss. There's certainly a lot of people deserve a little, and unfortunately, one guy deserves a lot, and that's just, I think, the conclusion that we came to across the board. Accurately portraying that, Gabe?
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, there's a lot of players who could have made better contributions in this game. Mistakes were made that ended up losing the game. It's unfortunate, but, you know, sometimes that's just the way it happens. Fortunately for the Ravens, it's happened that way a lot in the past few years. But, you know, we have to hope that, you know, there is a way to turn that around and have the coin fall on the other side next time.
Yeah, indeed. A little bit of 2-point conversion logic in there. If you're into that, hopefully people, you know, want to hear about that. As a certain, I feel like it's a bifurcated audience in some ways, that you have an audience which already kind of understands when it's good to go for two, and they understand the analytics. You have a very thin strip of people who care to understand the analytics of the situation, care to understand the math, but don't know it. That's a very small group of people. And then you have a large group of people who have been football fans for a very long time. To be respectful as I can about them, that it's also taken NFL coaches a long time to come around to mathematical perceptions about the game that have been known for decades. But the last 30 years of the 2-point conversion, basically, I think it started in 94 or in that about that time, have been a slow migration of coaching philosophy towards more broad use of the 2-point conversion, most notably the one we talked about in the first show, which was, you know, do you go for two when you get to within eight late in the football game?
Yeah, I mean, we're both in alignment there that you absolutely want to tie the game or make it so that it's a, you know, a 7-point opportunity the next score you have. And, you know, we got into the numbers a little bit, but yeah, generally going for two is a positive move, especially when you have the chance to give yourself an advantage in the scoring, so that, you know, one more score will either tie it or give you the lead. That's almost always going to be advantageous for you.
Yeah. Well, completely in agreement of that. Of course, let's talk about the pass rush a little bit, because we didn't get to that in the first episode. It's interesting because the Allen was very much focused on a ball out quick basis, almost seemed to have a Wilson-esque discomfort in the pocket without pressure existing. And, you know, we've seen that from Russell Wilson specifically moving around because he just can't see properly over the middle of the field. And it just gets very antsy, obviously. Allen really wants to get the ball out of his hands, really wanted to in this game, I think largely because he didn't want the turnover risk. He wants to throw to an open receiver as soon as he sees him. There being a little bit lower chance of a big play, but less of a chance of interception. That was certainly seemed to be the Bills' way in this football game. And out of it, they had five ample time and space opportunities for Allen the entire game and seven pressures, which is an okay relationship. But when you have 23 passes and 11 of those are ball out quick, it's the ball out quick plays that really dominated the Bills offense in this game.
Yeah. The Ravens definitely wanted to limit big plays. And not that the Bills were taking a lot of shots downfield, but you know, I think they tackled well. They kept the plays in front of them. They were able to kind of collapse the pocket, I think, pretty well in terms of the pass rush. They were not playing an aggressive pass rush. There was more of a contain type thing because what kind of a threat Allen can be with his legs. Yeah. But I think overall they did a good job, and it wasn't a lot of dropbacks, frankly. You know, I mean, this was a run heavy attack that the Bills decided to game plan around. And there weren't that many opportunities for the Ravens to even get after him. And you know, the Bills were in the lead too. So they were trying to run the ball, trying to eat up clock. We talked a little bit about that in the first half as well. So it really wasn't an opportunity for the Ravens to kind of get after the passer as they have in previous matchups where they've had the lead, for instance. So it was just kind of a bunch of different kind of things coming into that way. But given the opportunity set that they had, I think they did a good job of limiting the Bills' passing attack.
Yeah, I would say so. The secondary had a good game, I thought. And we talked about this a little bit the first episode. You know, you have some offsetting conditions. Conditions were crappy probably for throwing the ball in terms of being a wet, cold game. Allen seems to be fairly immune to that. He's also a good quarterback, so that goes in the other direction in terms of making it difficult. I thought it was good that the Ravens basically responded well from a poor game defending the pass last week against Russell Wilson to a very good game, I thought, of defending it against Allen. With ample time and space, they gave up 5 plays for 33 yards, 6.6 yards per play. That's about 10 yards below the standard for that number of plays. With the ball out quick, and this is the big one because this is most of the plays, 11 plays, 38 yards. So only 3.5 yards per play with the ball out quick. That's 28 yards below standard for that. And then they had 7 times where they got pressure, and that included a pressure by Travis Jones on the 34-yard throw to Shakir, which mutes these a little bit, but they got 55 net yards on those plays, 7.9 yards per play. That's 31 yards above expectations. In total, a nice total of 7 yards lower than expectation. That's always good to do against a good quarterback like Allen. And again, conditions you could point to as being something that they should have been in pretty good shape on. But I'm generally very happy with the defensive effort. The coverage unit's effort relative to the opportunity set that the pass rush got gave Allen.
Yeah, and like we already said, Allen wasn't looking to take risks, you know, and that's kind of how he's been playing this entire season. He's been, contrary to previous years where Josh Allen has been a little bit more of a kind of like
gunslinger,
YOLO, he's throwing the ball down the field. This season, very much the opposite. I think there was they definitely kind of ingrained in him this take care of the ball, just play within yourself, play within the offense. We'll run the ball well. We'll use your legs. We'll get some yard after the catch with our receivers. I think part of that is because they don't have those ball winners at receiver that maybe they had last year. The elite route runner that they had was Stephon Diggs for many years. They don't have those players really at wide receiver. So you may not have that ability to just kind of like, you know, drop back and sling the ball down the field. They don't have the deep threat that they had before in Gabe Davis. So very different kind of weapons available to them. And I think in terms of the way their team was constructed, the way that, you know, Allen is able to take on that kind of like mantle and orchestrate the offense the way he has, he's done an incredible job with it. And for the Ravens to kind of limit, you know, their ability to be very much of a threat passing the ball at all, I think it's exactly what they wanted to do. And they gave the team a chance to win the game, keep them in it by how they were able to contain it, Allen's ability to, you know, convert on some third downs and things like that.
Right. Yeah. I'm in agreement. I think they're generally very good. They're, you know, probably didn't keep up with the sticks as well as they could have with their run game. Although there's nothing wrong with getting 4.4 yards per carry. They got 12 first downs rushing the ball. They did a great job of converting on relatively short yardage when they needed to. The one exception being the fourth and or the third and two from the goal line where they stopped him for no gain. Here is some funky things about the pass rush. Orr used seven rushes of 5+. That 30% number, by the way, is high for the Ravens. They haven't reached 30% in many games. Those seven plays generated 18 total yards, 2.6 yards per play. No sacks, but they got after Allen. Allen wanted no part of the pressure, got rid of it. Most notably among those plays was the potential intentional grounding with the blitz from Wiggins. That was a good one, but they did not. Allen didn't do well with extra rushers, and he's clearly trying to get rid of the football. Deceptive elements. They used a variety of things. They used off-ball blitzes. They used six total, one double among those. So it's five plays. So 0.26 per play. And those plays gained 4 net yards. Okay. I'm going to go through all these. The stunts, 3 all singles, 6.3 yards per play. Small sample size, not a lot to draw from that. 6.3 yards per play. Wouldn't consider that as off of normal standards for really anything. Simulated pressures, 2, both incomplete, 1 quarterback hit. 2 plus elements, 3 such plays, all incomplete passes, including that same quarterback hit. It was the Wiggins quarterback hit in both those cases. It was a game where if I'm putting this all together, I'm seeing a Ravens team that they were very successful with numbers and they're very successful with deception. And they were very kind of meeting it out with an eyedropper.
Yeah. I think part of the reason why they're successful was because of how limited it was. Because when you do the same thing over and over again, it becomes easier to diagnose. So it's kind of like, you know, in baseball, you know, you're pitching, you have different pitches, you have your fastball, you have your changeup. They use their changeup very sparingly in this game, but when they used it, it was very effective. So I think, you know, if they had used it more frequently, there would have been more times where, you know, they could have beaten it. You see it more common, you see it more regularly, you have a better chance of dissecting it and knowing when it's coming and knowing how to attack it. I do think, you know, this season as a whole, we saw a lot less of things like the stunts and the twists and the simulated pressures than we had in the previous couple of seasons under Mike McDonald. I don't know if that's just the nature of how Zachary Orr wanted to coach the defense or call the defense, or if he just didn't have a much mastery or grasp of how best to utilize players in those ways. They also obviously lost, you know, defensive line coach. That might be part of the reason why they didn't feel like they had quite the nuanced, maybe teaching as how to execute on those plays. Also, they lost some personnel. You know, we saw, you know, Patrick Queen be a large part of how they used to pick, you know, offensive linemen and free up rush lanes and use him a lot on blitzes last year. So I think it's partially personnel. I think it's partially just coaching experience, and for the most part, they haven't been bad in the way that they've been able to get pressure this year, but I do think they could potentially build in a little bit more of that and be a more effective unit and better take advantage of the skill players you have.
Yeah, it is hard to like find fault with it when they finish second in the league in sacks.
Yeah.
They have a good back end that helped the front end generate pressure, because you can't separate the impacts of these two units completely. They're like pitching and fielding. It's just too many interconnected pieces to really say, yeah, that was all the pass rush, or yes, this was all the coverage. It's usually a combination of the two. What I try and do with this opportunity set is just it's admittedly just a shot to try and do it as effectively as I can with a you know, a limited window into this. But I will say that this pass rush in general has become more pea-sized after he showed up, that it became a more conservative pass rush, many fewer blitzes. You know, they basically had a apply limited deception and numbers approach versus basically every quarterback. The one exception were the two Giants guys who were, you know, rookies on earth. Basically, they went after them pretty heavily with both numbers and deception. But they didn't really do that with other quarterbacks. The more experienced quarterbacks they faced, which is most of the quarterbacks they faced this year, they really didn't go after them very much.
Yeah, I think it is definitely something that we'll see maybe a little bit more of in the future. But who knows? Maybe that's just not Orr's like kind of way of coaching defense. And we don't know how he might change. This is his first year, obviously, you know, in the defensive coordinator position. I think there is room for a little bit more of it. And I think just kind of like the timeliness and when you call it is very effective. And like we talked, I talked about earlier, you know, calling in the right moments can have just as much of an impact as doing it a lot more in the wrong moments. So it's an area where I'd like to see, you know, maybe some development, but I think that you can't, like you said, quibble too much with the results that they were able to get this year. I do think, you know, it was a pretty big difference, especially if you look at like how the secondary was used in blitzes. That was something we saw a lot in previous schemes. This year wasn't nearly as often. And when they did use it, I think it was very effective. You know, you talked about the Nate Wiggins play that led to a negative play. So that goes back to the same thing of not using it that often. You're not looking for it as often. So I think that overall good coaching, maybe there are a few areas where you can make it a little bit better, but if you're going to be telling me that you keep the opposing passer to like 5 yards per attempt, 5.5 yards per attempt and limit his ability to scramble to like basically nothing at all, that's a huge win for the defense.
Yeah. They didn't let him get away for that big run that we've seen a lot from Allen at other times. I mean, he's had a lot of tush push runs, a lot of short yardage conversions and whatnot, where you mentioned the first episode, you think a lot of his value comes from, but he didn't, you know, he's got 500 and some yards. He's not a Lamar Jackson runner, but he does have the ability to break some long runs at times. And he didn't really do that against the Ravens. So that was good. Okay. One other thing I want to hit on before we leave the pass rush is, where do you really rank the pass rush among the Ravens draft needs? And I guess one of the points I would ask specifically about, cause I'm not trying to trick you or anything, is that the Ravens have had a lot of success finding the extra pass rusher in terms of, an older veteran guy who they can still get value out of.
Yeah. I think it's not the top of the list, but it is always going to be a need. And this is, you know, coming from the perspective of, we don't know if Kyle Van Noy will be back on the team next year.
He is signed, right? I think he signed for
this year. He might be. I was thinking he was a 1 year deal.
Well, it still could be a 2-for-1, but I don't think he's retiring after a 12 sack year.
I don't think he's retiring either. If he's back next year, that's fantastic.
He's signed for 25.
Okay.
He carries a $6.1 million cap hit.
Oh, that's a huge value. So that's great. I was thinking he was a 1 year deal for some reason. I think it's not a priority. There's other positions. I think it would probably be second tier priority for sure. Do you want to try to find, you know, a diamond in the rough? Maybe. We don't know what a decent Isaac will look like with more time in the building.
Good point.
You know, he has some nice traits in terms of like explosiveness, athleticism, that kind of thing. He's a little bit undersized, but you know, there are ways I think you can use him. Tavius Robinson had a nice, you know, developmental year where he's become more of a rotational player for them, and you know, he might take another step as well. He seems like he's kind of put it together a little bit in terms of what he can do. So I don't necessarily think it's a must need, but looking to the future, I think you do want to see what this defense could potentially look like with an impact pass rusher. If you could find one of those players, I think it would help out the whole defense a lot, because they're very close to being, you know, extremely, extremely good, but there's still a few times when it looks like they don't have enough juice when it comes just to be able to get after the quarterback with a 4-man rush, especially against better offensive lines in better conditions. Like in a dome, for instance, they kind of might get a little bit more issue, but it's not the biggest hole moving forward. That's for sure.
This was the first game all year the Ravens didn't get 2 sacks, so they got at least 2 sacks in every game. In their regular season, if you want to count it that way, they're close to the longest in team history. It might be the longest in team history. It's close to the. I want to say it's close to the record. Like the record's 21 straight games or something with 2+ sacks, and the Ravens are about 19 or something right now. But I'll have to get my facts straight on that one before I'm ready to sit on it. But it's you know, as much as we can say about the Ravens pass rush, I think the one guy who is really on the hot seat this offseason is David Ajabo. He'll be entering year four. He has shown absolutely nothing. This was a particularly poor game for David Ajabo. Got nothing done in this game.
Penalty.
Got the illegal use of hands penalty. And I don't think he's a certainty to make the team. I really didn't think he was this year, but he did make it. And he's been active at times where I thought maybe Adisa Isaac would have been the better choice. Now, I'm not there for practices, so I don't know. I don't know enough to say, and I trust Harbaugh's judgment to know that Adisa Isaac is missing in some way. But David Ajabo is not a special teams contributor, so they lose something by not bringing out Adisa Isaac. And there were times earlier this year, where they said, okay, no, we're activating Isaac over Ajabo for just that reason.
Yeah, I think that Ajabo was a risk. I mean, mm-hmm. I think obviously, right? He was coming off of a major injury. They thought they had a value. They thought they had a connection with him because of the Mike McDonald, you know, coaching hire. And that, I think there was like just the desire to bring in that upside. Obviously, more injuries have held him back. I think it would be nice to see him have an opportunity to break out. But it could be that he just doesn't have the, you know, the athletic ability anymore. Edge rusher is a very athleticism dependent position. If you don't have the ability to have an explosive get off, if you don't have the ability to bend the edge and use, you know, your speed to kind of get into defensive or to offensive tackles and push the pocket, you're just a guy. And he's not an exceptionally good run defender. He's not the worst there, but he's not horrible. So I just don't see him getting that, you know, burst back most likely after the injuries. So I think you just kind of have to write it off as a gamble that didn't pay out. And you hope that you can find somebody else that will, you know, take those snaps and do a better job with them.
Yeah, it's not like they haven't had some other second round picks, particularly at pass rusher, that didn't work out. No. So, and some of them worked out just in year three and four. They really, their value didn't become apparent until then, like Kruger, which was, he was, you know, certainly a player who there was a risk of that not working out. But I don't see Ajabo as being a particularly physical player. And I think we were kind of a little hoodwinked in terms of what he'd accomplished at Michigan. In terms of his value as a run defender. I don't think that's really, Tavius Robinson is the run defender.
Yeah.
And the other guy they use in run defense situations is they move Harrison up to play outside linebacker. So they're not really looking for anyone else to be it, but Ajabo ain't it. He ain't it. He's not really a physical guy. He doesn't, you know, out muscle offensive tackles. And he's not the kind of slippery you'd hope for either, honestly, to get after the pass rusher, whether it's bend or having some great move. He's worked with Chuck Smith now for 2 years, so he's had a chance to, you know, to pick up some things. It really hasn't worked out.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I felt, you know, at the moment it was probably a good investment to try and strike gold, you know, in the second round to get someone who was considered to be a top 10 talent before the injury. But, you know, sometimes you take a swing and you miss. And unfortunately, it looks like that's the case here.
Would you rather have Pickens, because he was the guy. Coach Evans came out particularly strongly on the draft show for Pickens.
Yeah.
And would you rather have him as opposed to Ajabo at this exact moment?
It's hard to say no to Pickens just because at least he's been productive.
Right.
I personally wouldn't want Pickens on my team because I think he's unreliable and selfish. And that's the kind of player that the Steelers love a wide receiver. It's not the kind of player the Ravens love a wide receiver. I don't think he was probably even on the Ravens draft board, to be perfectly honest. Just because of some of his issues in college, maturity issues, off the field issues, things like that. And they had a need for wide receiver and they said, no, thank you. Yeah. So that to me was you know, I think a pretty clear case of them not being interested in him. And would he make this team better, especially with the skill set that the Ravens kind of could use at wide receiver? I think so. But then you have to deal with the headache that comes with it. So, yeah.
Exactly. Across the board. I mean, you know, it's Deontay Johnson, in theory, could have helped this team, in theory. But he wasn't interested in the role the Ravens had in mind for him and what the Ravens thought they were acquiring when they got him. And he ended up in the same upset situation after a win with the Texans and caught under similar circumstances. So I do think that's a serious concern, is that the Ravens, since they really can't have a number one receiver. Okay, hear me out on this argument, because I've said it before in the show, but I'm going to say it one more time. And I want to get kind of your reaction to it. The Ravens can't really have a number one receiver because Lamar Jackson is the number one playmaker in this offense. So you can't change how Jackson has options with the football by who needs to have targets funneled to them. So you want good receivers. You want guys who can adapt to Jackson. You want guys who can extend plays, but it means you end up with guys who are not number one receivers in the term that people tend to use it. You know, the guys who Terrell Owens, the guys who want the football just all the time and won't be happy otherwise. I don't think you can have them in a Lamar Jackson offense. It's too run centric and too Jackson centric.
Yeah, I think I definitely agree in the large sense of that type of player. You know, the wide receivers around the league tend to have that diva nature to them. That may not be the case for all of them. There probably are some receivers who will be extremely happy to play with Lamar Jackson. He's an incredible player. And no, you probably won't get your 120, 130 targets, but you're going to be coming to play with one of the most exciting players in the NFL. So that's a trade-off. I think there are some players who would probably take, but is it the guy that the Ravens need? I don't know. I don't think it's a missing piece for this team at all. I think the way this team needs to look at is building the trenches. But anyway, that's not the conversation for right now.
All right. Well, let's talk about some individual players. Who would you like to talk about first?
You know, I mentioned him earlier a little bit, very briefly. Kyle Van Noy, to me, has been, if not the Ravens defensive MVP this year, he's been one of the just joys to watch on the football field week in, week out. Probably their most consistent pass rusher, definitely their most consistent edge pass rusher. The production is there to back that up. Pressures, the sacks, the veteran leadership. He's been such an impactful player at an elder age. He had another solid game in this one. You know, he was able to get some pressure diagnosed. I think the play is pretty well that he was in there for. Is he going to be your best run defender? No, but that's not why he's on your team at this point in his career. And I think having somebody who has that experience, he's been on championship winning teams, that has a lot of impact on the overall performance of the team. And I'm just really happy to see him succeed the way he has. I think that was one of the best signings that, you know, Eric DaCosta has made in recent years.
I know leadership is a funny thing when you look for it on an NFL team, because it's not always clear who's going to be a great leader. And sometimes it's just the guy who yells loudest. And sometimes the guy who can just whip himself into a frenzy and, you know, go Ray Lewis before a game, we're told Nnamdi Matabike is that way now. Kyle Van Noy has the intelligence to be an outstanding leader, and he's a communicator. He does stand-up comedy during the offseason as a hobby. I mean, he has all of that necessary to talk to a crowd, to really get them to feel something, that he could be a great leader. I don't feel like the Ravens or he are taking advantage of that opportunity and even increasing his value more. You know, if you're Kyle Van Noy and you're looking, well, yeah, I'm going to play 2025 in Baltimore. Maybe we have another chance at the Super Bowl. Should be looking at, you know, I just had a 12 and a half sack season. I could be playing somewhere else 2 years from now for, you know, maybe on my last contract. And I want part of the value they place on that to be as a leader. It doesn't even have to think from a monetary perspective. Just how about impacting your team and wanting to do that? Or maybe wanting to pass something along to the young players that you influence or that want to come to you. You know, Marlon Humphrey is a younger guy. I think he probably has more leadership put out there right now than Van Noy does, largely because he's willing to talk and he interacts well with other people.
Yeah, I mean, I think Humphrey, I mean, clearly the leader of the secondary. I think he has been, like you said, more vocal. He's vocal about holding himself and his teammates accountable when they've had poor performances repeatedly this year. And I think he's a big part of how they've been able to turn that around. And I think you need to have, obviously, multiple leaders. I mean, you talked about Ray Lewis, but, you know, there was a lot of people who said Ed Reed was actually, you know, the quiet leader in the clubhouse who everybody, like, would actually, you know, turn to. And when he talked, everybody listened. You know, Ray Lewis always talked, but when Ed Reed talked, you know, everybody was paying attention. And you need to have those different types of dynamics, I think, in a locker room, different types of leadership qualities.
What is Dax, are you
tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker on all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for
in Dax's domain. We see all, so we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge, trucks up 3.9%.
That's a great offer.
I know.
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And hopefully, you know, being able to keep, I think, majority of this defense together moving forward will help, you know, keep, you know, that desire to get those veterans, you know, their rings if they haven't gotten them yet, or that they have in Van Noy's place, you know, get them another one. I think there's a lot of desire on the offensive side of the ball, obviously, for to see Lamar Jackson win, for everybody's playing for him. They hear everything, you know, in the media, and they don't want that to be on their guy. And then defense also can have that type of leadership and keep players accountable when they make mistakes and come back and be better for it.
Right. All right. Well said. I don't think we need to go any deeper down that hole. I want to talk about Michael Pierce a little bit. And we did have somebody submitted a mailbag question asking, let me get to it here, because why did Michael Pierce not see more snaps? Was a question that was asked here, and we have several. And here I'm trying to get to it. I'll get to the person who named it when you respond to it. But Michael Pierce was only on the field for about 15 snaps in this ball game and made five tackles. So he's clearly a big part of run defense. He was one of the players who was winning and standing people up at the line of scrimmage and getting involved in tackles that I thought was great. I want to say he had defensive wins on most of his plays. I may be thinking of Tavius Robinson, but it was primarily plays that did not keep the other team up with the sticks, which, by the way, you would figure Pierce to make since he's close to the line of scrimmage like that. But in terms of getting him on the field, the one thing the Ravens did not do in this game was really try and go to a base defense where they had both Pierce and Jones on the field at the same time, which would have been a really interesting decision to make. But they always went to either Urban or Washington as their third guy in base defense packages, along with sometimes Jones, Matabike, and sometimes all three of Pierce, Urban, and Washington. But they always went to Urban basically as their extra guy as a five tech. Urban or Washington. Do you think they lost something by not getting Pierce on the field more in this game?
I think you could have used him more. I think if you look at the way that the Ravens have play their defensive tackles this season. They've done this rotation. You know, they've had Drones and Matabike playing together almost entirely. And then it's been Washington and Pierce in kind of like a rotational unit. And it seemed to be the case as well when they were in their nickel package. It was almost entirely Matabike and Jones played, I think, like 75 or 80% of the snaps in this game. So I think that's part of the reason why there was less snaps for Pierce. He was playing more in the base package, which wasn't on the field as much. So that's probably where a lot of that kind of discrepancy comes from. Could you have used Jones and Pierce together, especially, you know, when they're looking like they might be running the ball pretty predominantly at you? I think there was more opportunity for that. Because that really helps you in the middle of the defense to kind of clog up some of those rushing lanes. But
it would have been really nice to try. I've been hoping to see it all season. They've done it just a couple snaps here and there. It's really not something they've used. They're very much a pairings team. Connor Kellerstrass, by the way, is the person who asked the question. But they're very much of a pairings team. So Jones and Matabike are almost always on the field together. And Pierce and Washington are almost always on the field together. And then they have Urban that they added as this extra guy into these packages along. And they did a little bit of different pairings in this game, for instance, with Matabike and Pierce on the field together at the same time. But basically they stick with those basic two and two pairings. I think at this point in his career, and frankly, with his current waistline, there is going to be a limit on how much they're willing to play Pierce. So I, you know, they may just feel like, look, the upper bound is 15 or 18 or whatever. I have him for 13 snaps in this game, but that includes not penalties. And he had 15 in the game book. So 15 would be including the penalties. I don't really see a problem with that being too low a number for Pierce. And by the way, in terms of the actual results, all very similar with and without Pierce, as well as Pierce played, the results overall on the plays were similar.
Yeah, I don't have a big problem with it. And like you said, he's coming back from injury. He hasn't played as many snaps since he's been back from injury. I don't know if those are related or if it's just kind of the nature of the games they've played. The only thing I could have seen maybe earlier on in the game when you're getting carved up by the run, you might have plugged him in a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair enough. We got one related question on this. That's from Garnett West, who's a big friend of the show, longtime. Big time Twitter handle, by the way, @Garnett478. I'd recommend him as a Twitter follow. But he says, "Good evening, fellows. After watching the game, it has come to my attention that the interior defense did not live up to the dominating expectations like I thought. For the $20 million year contract that Matabike has, is it okay to be disappointed?" I really, in this game, and I think in general for the season, I don't think it's been a bad year or should be an unexpected bad year for Matabike. But I'll just say in this game particularly, I think the field conditions played a big role in how easy it was for the Bills to get the blocks they wanted set up specifically. You just look at how hard it is for Jones or Pierce, Jones more, honestly, or Matabike to get their feet set on any kind of way that they need to not be moved as part of a double team. They were consistently getting basically stood up, handed off, and one of the two was then moving up to level two and making an effective block. I think it was more conditions related, Garnett, if I had to say it in terms of what happened this time. But Gabe?
Well, we were in alignment on that for sure. The conditions were not great. And I think you look on the other side of the ball as well. You know, the Ravens offensive line was able to move around the Bills pretty easily as well. And maybe the Bills don't have the same quite high caliber of defensive linemen, especially interior, but they're a very good defensive front team. They have excellent edge defenders. Ed Oliver is a good player. And the Ravens were able to remove them pretty easily in the run game. I think for this game in particular, Matabike didn't have like any of the kind of splash plays that you might hope for him in like big moments, but it's a good offensive line. They're going against poor conditions. I think you have to look at the breadth of the season and in terms of what he's been able to do in terms of generating pressure for the Ravens, he's one of their most consistent pressure players. And coming from the interior, it's not the easiest thing to do. He's also lined up, you know, at different alignments. He's lined up over the center. He's lined up over the offensive tackle, over the guard. He's a versatile player. And I think he's, is he worth the contract he got? It's hard to say any player unless they're like, you know, in like defensive player of the year are worth those types of dollars a lot of the time. But I think he got a fair deal for what he brings to the table.
Right. Yeah, it was certainly expensive cornerstone contract. I think one of the things you look at is he works very well with Travis Jones. And that's a really good pairing that gets singles. And the Ravens are now moving him around a lot. They'd move Jones some around in this game, if you didn't notice, to be used on the edge a couple of times. So that was really kind of cool. One of the things they did as passers, just when that happens, it usually says twist to me. They're going to try and do something involving trying to get Madueke to move one or two gaps to the inside to block. But the other thing it can mean is they've got some blitz planned where they're going to drop these guys from the line of scrimmage. They did some of that too. So that's how Pierce got his interception, of course, last week. So whatever week it was that he got is against the Browns, right?
So, yeah, that was week 18.
Yeah. All right. So anyway, exciting stuff there. So I had Pierce. Who do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about Tre'Davious White. I think he's an interesting player this year to look at. He had some ups and downs, I think, in his time in Ravens uniform. Wasn't immediately used that much, kind of spot player. But I think he might have played his most snaps he had as a Raven in this game. I don't know if that's true, but he definitely played a lot of snaps, and he was predominantly outside, you know, corner in this game. I think he played well. Obviously, there was that one penalty that I think we all earn agreement should not have been a penalty on him. Mm-hmm. He's, I believe, a free agent to be.
UFA, yep.
It's an interesting position for the Ravens, whether or not they could look at maybe getting him at a kind of relatively low price tag. I mean, you've kind of tried him out for half a season, and if you like what you saw, I think there's an opportunity. I mean, the Ravens are going to need to figure out that third corner position next year, because they have you know, some young guys who haven't really panned out. Maybe TJ Tampa is that guy. He didn't really get the chance to play at all this year, but I think regardless, it makes sense to have another veteran in that mix. And I think, you know, he played well in this game. He's played well in a number of games for the team, and I think he has, you know, the experience. He's played at a very high level in the league, and I think, you know, he still has that desire to go out there and compete.
Yeah, I'm not sure he's going to fall into the Ravens price range. Mm-hmm. And I think if you want him, you probably want him as your fourth corner and not your third, would be my feeling about it. Like, depending on how the Ravens are going to set up with the slot. I think Arthur Mollett has probably gone. There's a little bit of cap savings from cutting him. So they're going to have to find somebody new for the slot, and that could be rolled into their whole safety realignment if they get the guys for the back end that they want. But they've got Humphrey, and Humphrey seems to be very comfortable in the slot now. They've got Wiggins, and they're set with him. So getting the third corner might be the guy they get in a relatively high draft spot, because I think it's still a need to get a little younger at that spot. Or maybe Tampa is a guy that they right along. Tampa did not meet the minimum standard for amount of snaps seen in his rookie year. Like that, I consider that to be around somewhere between 60 and 100 snaps, and Tampa had less than that. Mm-hmm. But if he'd had, yes, I think Anthony Averett, for example, a guy who's going to be a starter at some point in the league, I think he might have had 65 as a rookie, and, you know, got some in rotationally, kind of forced his way into a little bit of play. Injuries happened. He jumped in. JAD won't be on the team next year, I would presume, and so it means that there's an extra spot, one higher on the totem pole. That either goes to a draftee, it could go to Trey White, or it could go to Tampa moving up the slot. But they're in need of one or more cornerbacks for this next year.
Yeah, I don't know what his price tag is going to be. I mean, he seemed like a player who was on the outside looking in the middle of the season. And I know he's had some injuries that he's dealt with over the years. So maybe that will kind of push down the cost. But I think you can get him at a relatively cheap veteran deal. I think he's someone that I would like to bring back.
Okay. All right. So you brought up White. Let's talk a little bit about Wiggins' play, because I continue to be very excited about where his career is heading. I think he's had a fine rookie year, and a lot of metrics that look at the amount of separation he's giving up or the amount of the passer rating he's giving up. He just gave up his first TD in that Pittsburgh game to Pickens on the long play on the right sideline, where it was kind of between him and Washington. It was probably half touchdown to each would have been fair if you wanted to do it that way, but they assigned it, at least PFF did, to Wiggins. But he's had a fine year. I mean, he's finally found the football in the air, returned it for six, has been hands on the football a lot, and in particular from the very first game in training in the preseason, we saw him really doing that well. This was a good game for him. I mean, he played very well. One of the receptions that was interesting PFF assigned to him, but I really don't consider to be his problem, was that 13-yard reception that went, I believe, to Hollins, also crossing the field out of 4x1, that where Romo made a specific point of mentioning it. But there's no way he can get down to cover Mac Hollins on that play. And I thought it did look like possible Harrison might have had responsibility to spy on the play or couldn't leave his spot somehow. But he was the only player who had a chance to even impact the route. And probably his best chance was to jam it and hit him. And instead he put a hand on him and let him continue going. And that to me was a strange assignment of that target, but it was what it was. He gave up, as I saw it, one target for 7 yards the whole game. And that's pretty damn good.
Yeah. I don't know if Bleep Football Focus does coverage grades or coverage just responsibilities if it's in man coverage and you're the person who's lined up across from him when the play is snapped, if he's automatically your guy. I think that kind of makes sense to do it that way if you're going to be consistent with it, but running that type of mesh route where you're picking off the defender, right, like you said, it basically makes it impossible for that person to stay in alignment with the guy you're defending. So I agree with you in the overall assessment that he's played extremely well in this game. I think over the course of the season, he's continued to improve and impress, gain confidence. His speed is very apparent. You've seen him, seemingly maybe out of step, but then he has the makeup speed to get in there and make a play on the ball. He, unlike some other Ravens defenders, he seems to have a knack to kind of like be able to make a turn and identify the ball, or at least look like he's identifying the ball and not kind of completely lose where everything is happening. He doesn't panic in those moments. I think he's going to be a very good corner for the Ravens in the coming years. And I think it was, an excellent selection, especially where they drafted him. To get that kind of starting high end corner at the end of the first round is a steal, frankly.
It was great value. Great, absolutely great value. And it wouldn't surprise me if, he's contending for a Pro Bowl at this point next year. He seems to be entrenched right now. I don't think he's the kind of player you ever take off the field in 2025. I just don't. The Ravens don't really have enough talent. If Brandon Stevens isn't here, he's the main guy who was taking all the snaps away in base, for example. But I think Wiggins is a guy you have on any down. Much more dog in him than you would expect in the run game, too. He's been a much better guy coming downhill and making tackles than his frame would indicate.
Yeah, I mean, that was like one of the biggest knocks on him, not necessarily his willingness to defend the run, but his size. General size.
Yeah.
He's very slight of frame, but he's feisty. He's willing to lay a hit. And, he very much plays in the Ravens style football.
All right, I named Wiggins. Maybe one more, and then we'll do a few mailbag questions if you're good.
Wow. A lot of people had good games. I think someone, just to throw him out there because he's one of my favorite players on the team, Ardarius Washington, another player I think he potentially has a bright future with the Ravens, depending on how they handle his contract situation moving forward. I love his style of play. He's a big hitter for someone who's small. It's similar to Nate Wiggins. He's not, but he's even like short as well. Mm-hmm. But he, he's willing to throw his nose in at every single time. He's made so many big plays for the Ravens. He's probably the key to their whole defensive turnaround, I think, putting him in the starting lineup and having him paired with Hamilton on the back end. He's opened up so many things for them. He's a versatile player. I honestly love everything that he's done for the team. And I think he had a good game. You know, he stuck his nose in there and run defense. He didn't have any coverage busts that I can remember. He seemed always to be in the right position.
Yeah, he had the third and two stop at the 2 yard line, right? He basically wrapped up the legs of the ball carrier. I forget if it was Allen or it was running back. Yeah. And he wasn't letting go. So
yep.
Good thing. Yeah. I mean, I love him also. And it's just a matter of how they do it this offseason, but I think they're going to try and sign him to a multi-year deal.
Yeah.
He's coming off his third official year, and it's his fourth year in the league. But obviously, he lost a year of service time due to being on the practice squad for 1 year. Much like Geno Stone, the Ravens are lucky still to have him at this point, because there have been were opportunities for that other teams could get him away from the Ravens. But anyway, they've got him now, and I think it's the RFA tender for the second round is like about $5 million, which seems kind of pricey. So I think the Ravens will be incented to try and get a multi-year deal yeah. done, and maybe 3 years, $12 million kind of thing. It should be, you know, a good amount of benefit to both sides, but it may be that if he's starting at $5.2 million, he's not going to want to sign a contract like that. He's going to want that for at least for 3 years, say.
I mean, frankly, I'd be willing to do a four-year deal in the 20s. 25 million range. I think his value to the team has been there. His only knock to me is his ability to stay healthy, because he has right. had dealt injuries, and the smaller frame kind of lends itself to potentially having that. But his impact on the field, I think, is undeniable. I mean, mm-hmm. he really is a well-rounded player. We talked about his ability. He can play in the slot. He can play strong safety very well. They've kept him around because of what he can do, his versatility. That play has borne itself out when he's finally been given the full-time starting opportunity. You have the player that you've kept in the building. I think you reward him with that contract. I mean, $5 to $7 million per year, I don't think is a crazy range for a starting safety in the NFL.
It's probably above where I'd be willing to go if I'm trying to negotiate this deal. But he's in a good situation for him, is that the Ravens have to use a second round tender or risk losing him for a match the offer sheet deal. Otherwise. So I think it's possible. But I look at the same problems you do. I look at the career of Bob Sanders and how great he was and how small he was and how quickly that ruined him, that I don't think I'd quite go to the same level. But he's a very versatile piece, and boy, the Ravens, he saved the Ravens season in a lot of ways this year by being able to move to the back end and be at a higher level than either Williams or Jackson.
Yeah, I mean, it's a night and day. I mean, honestly, like, I mean, it wasn't just him. It was putting Hamilton in that role as well. It was the pairing sure. of them two together. But having Washington be the versatile piece that he has allowed Hamilton to also be a versatile piece and really give them the flexibility to kind of move them around as needed. You could play Hamilton deep, you could play Washington deep. I really would be sad if they can't keep him around for more than just the one coming season.
Two players I mentioned very quickly. Kyle Hamilton had another fantastic game, all pro level, and we don't have to talk about him every time because he's so great and we expect all these things out of him, but made a bunch of tackles close to the line of scrimmage, did a great job in terms of pass defense, four targets, 4 yards, the big stat for Kyle Hamilton, in addition to leading the team in tackles. And Tavius Robinson, I thought, also had a great game, made a couple of really nice run stops. I believe he might have had 2 tackles for loss in this game. Also diagnosed a screen, went out and made the tackle. Just good stuff from him. You mentioned the developmental year on him earlier.
Yeah, I mean, nothing really else to say about Kyle Hamilton. I think he's probably the best safety in the NFL. I think he deserves all the accolades that he receives. The versatility, the impact, the ability to play in any type of scheme that you ask him to do, just really incredible player. Love Kyle Hamilton. He's a player that the Ravens need to lock up to whatever contract that they can when that time comes. And then Tavius Robinson, he had a great game. He's really grown, like we talked about, he's grown into that role. He's an edge setting player. He's gives you enough pass rush and intelligent play. I think he's really become more comfortable, given more opportunity. And, you know, I think, is he ever going to be a starting caliber edge? Probably not, but he can be a rotational player for you, and every team needs that. And he's someone potentially you can keep around for several years on a very affordable contract.
Right. All right. Let's see what else we have in the mailbag here real quickly. That might be it. We've got something from U. Cole made a comment on roster construction. These playoffs are confirmation of the Ravens' choices rather than repudiation. None of the teams left a more potent pass attack than the Ravens, and not having Flowers really hurt. Make some tweaks and run it back. I'm in complete agreement with you. I think the Ravens have built an incredibly powerful team over the last 2 years that was one of the best by DVOA standards. They beat the crap out of winning teams the whole year, and they happened to come up short against two very good teams at the wrong time, one each year. And sometimes that's the way it goes. Ask the Detroit Lions, ask the Minnesota Vikings, ask a lot of teams this year in terms of what went wrong with them, and ask teams every year who get upset in the playoffs. It's sad that Lamar didn't win it, but keep giving Lamar chances, and I think the chances are pretty good that the Ravens will make another run.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think the roster was constructed extremely well. If there's one area that I thought maybe was a bit suspect, was the offensive line this year. I think that's where you look at more than anything else in the coming offseason. You just want to have a little more consistency, especially on the interior. And I think they'll probably, you know, make those moves accordingly. But even the players that I think were kind of considered to be big challenges this year, they kind of turned it around over the course of the year. Falele ended up playing pretty well down the stretch. McCary, he's a little bit up and down, but for the most part, very reliable, especially in pass protection. Kind of cut down the penalties too by the end of the year. So I can't really complain too much about anything in terms of where this team is at right now.
No, very happy with it. There's a similar one is from Alvindo Royale. This is good stuff for the end of the season here. Can you also just put out a PSA that it's way better to have these tough Ravens losses than not? The Orioles taught me this. Tough losses beat years of sucking all day, every day. Yeah, think about, you know, being a Baltimore Ravens fan, you know, since about 19, whatever. Really since August 5th of 1986. And if you want to see what happened that day, go ahead and look it up. It's on baseballreference.com. But the Orioles have been a pretty much an overmatched franchise, despite making a couple runs at it during that time. And the Orioles have finally got a young team, and they're going to be exciting, and they're going to get to the playoffs and lose some probably in the coming years. And I much prefer that to sitting in seats, you know, trying to pull something good developmentally out of a game. I mean, how do you even stand being a Browns fan? All you've got is developmental hopes, and you've got a roster that's constructed to choke the life out of all developmental hopefuls.
Oh man, I can't imagine being a fan of a team like that for so many reasons. But yeah, I mean, we have so much to be grateful for the Ravens. Not only are they week in, week out, just a fun team to watch play. I mean, you have the most entertaining player in all football to watch a quarterback every single week. I think they're exceptionally coached. They're exceptionally put together from a team building standpoint, which you just talked about. They just haven't had, you know, the dominoes fall the correct way so far. And, you know, there may be some repudiation about, you know, why that's happened, but I think you have to know that going forward, the Ravens are going to be in position to succeed and be back in this same conversation year in and year out, just because of how well they are, you know, put together from the top down, starting at ownership, you know, coaching, general managers, all the pieces. They just have an exceptionally run organization.
Yeah. And I couldn't have said it any better. They happen to have the quarterback right now, and we all feel the pressure and the need to win while Lamar is good, because we all know it's not easy to switch horses. You look at Mike Tomlin, he's not been able to do it so far. And, you know, you look at the Cleveland Browns, and they've, you know, been through a bajillion quarterbacks. And even when they might've had the guy, they didn't really realize it with Baker Mayfield. I mean, it's very, very difficult to be in the kind of good situation the Ravens are. It does not happen by luck. It only happens with a great organization and a very well-run franchise. Anyway, I appreciate ending this show on a positive note, with a lot of, you know, the negativity coming out of the loss, and particularly the first episode, which was all about blame. But Gabe, wonderful talking football, always with you for a couple hours. Tell folks where they can talk football with you online.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Gabe Fergie. I mean, going into the off season, I'm probably going to start pretty soon, just to kind of taking a look at the draft. I always have a little bit of a desire to see, you know, who's out there for the Ravens. What are the kind of position strengths? You know, what are the players that are potentially going to be good fits in Baltimore? So I'm going to probably start, you know, looking at some players, maybe tweeting about them. You can also find me on Blue Sky with the same handle at Gabe Fergie. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's a sad time to end the season, but you know, there's a lot to be looking forward to, I think, with a team that has going to be bringing back, you know, a lot of the pieces that brought them so successfully to this point, and hopefully, you know, learn from the mistakes and come back stronger next year.
All right. Well said, Gabe. Other folks out there, thank you so much for all your great listenership this year. Had a great year in terms of new listeners, in terms of, you know, total listens, in terms of having people enjoying the pod. As always, I ask, share this with one more person, show an older person generally who doesn't really do podcasts, or someone who doesn't do podcasts. They might be a younger person, just how to play the thing directly off the air. Or if they're not in a podcast at all, show them the articles. And by the way, we did not have a defensive article this week, because of running around to Buffalo, getting back, not having the time to do it. Still will be an offensive line article later in the week. That'll be the last one of the year. Gabe, thanks again for joining me.
Ken, it's been a fun season. It's been great being on your podcast. So thanks again for having me, and look forward to the future.
I hope we can talk together many more times, and we'll talk to you later on Field Study.
Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that?
Yeah.
No hassle?
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
Stay warm and save every day. All in the Kroger app. Get tender USDA Choice boneless chuck roast or stew meat for $6.99 a pound. Then get 2-liter bottles of Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $1.49 each, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.